From theunce.com, this is The Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. It's been a while, but we're back with a big one. For the past half decade, Michael Travis and Jason Hahn have been tirelessly touring the country as Iodo. This live drumming on the fly production multi-instrumentalist duo plays 100% improvised shows hundreds of times a year. Since their inception all those years ago, Hahn and Travis remain unmatched, untouched, and incomparable in the electronic music industry. They've carved out their niche through sheer willpower, thousands of miles of asphalt, and hours upon hours of telepathy. Today we air an interview with Michael Travis from the end of the summer as he discusses his transition from live down-tempo and experimental act Zilla into the Iodo project, the massive Lotus stage setup and its impending retirement, as well as what it takes to get something so completely unique off the ground and in front of thousands of screaming fans. TheUnce.com is sponsoring the forthcoming fall tour, as well as the Iodo dates across Colorado this December. Currently, Jason Hahn is on the road as Prophet Massive, hitting Envy Nightclub in Knoxville, Tennessee this Friday for the big gigantic after party with Loudpack and Brills. More dates and info at TheUnce.com. We'll get to the interview in a second, but first I'd like to remind folks that at tickets.theunce.com you can find Michael Mennert Mafia packages to all the club dates on his Space Jazz Tour. The packages include tickets, posters, stickers, and more. This week Michael's in the Midwest hitting Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago, and Minneapolis with Odessa. Then he'll be headed back out west to finish out the tour with Mux Mool. Head to tickets.theunce.com to grab those. All right, let's get to the interview. Iodo is going to be where it is now. Huge tours, sellouts in clubs and theaters across the country, massive festival sets. Do you believe me? Do you believe that this little fun project that you and Jason developed would be where it is today?
I guess I'm supposed to say no. I had no idea.
You didn't have a master plan?
I did have a master plan, though. That's the thing about me is I'm kind of master plan-y. I mean, I didn't know for sure, but I was mostly just excited to get to play bass and guitar and keyboards, finally. But, you know, I'm always aiming for some sort of broader sensation or broader appeal and hoped that it would become that. Mm-hmm. It always felt pretty unique that, you know, we're still the only ones that are all improvised that I know of in any genre that is making a mark. Mm-hmm. But no, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have known. You know, I was happy to. I would never have thought we would have played Red Rocks 5 years ago, for instance.
Sure.
But I am happy that it's working out that way. It's exciting to see all that hard work, because it was the most excruciating touring that I've ever done was with Iodo, for sure.
Let's talk about that. Jamie Janiver told me that at one point you guys did, I think it was 90 shows in 108 days. Tell me about the physical toll that takes.
96 shows in 108 days was our most extensive tour. But then the next tour we did 2.5 months with only 2 days off. We did 33 in a row, then a day off, then 27 in a row and a day off, and then 18 in a row, and then the tour was over.
How do you stay healthy during that sort of run?
It's a path. It's like going to a profound meditation retreat or something. You might not like it, but you have to meditate 8 hours a day, and you know that it's doing well, and it's nourishing you. And that's the same with the touring, is that the playing every single night becomes the continuum. And so all you're really focusing on is those 3 hours you're on stage. And it's also, you know, and hanging out with people that are happy to meet you and are loving on you is very nourishing as well. So it's not that hard to stay healthy. And you're getting exercise, hauling shit in and out every day.
Sure.
Yeah, it was just a mode you get into and there's no thinking about it. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm healthier now for sure.
Now that you've put that in said, that time, that building period, do you feel like you need to push yourself to that extent each tour, or is it more you've laid the groundwork, now you can sort of ease back and focus more on bringing the right show and a good show every night?
Yeah, it is. There is some easing off for sure. There was definitely in the everyone's their own worst critic category, I fall very strongly in that. And it used to bug Jason a lot that we'd go out and these long tours, and I'd just walk off stage every night saying, that was shit, that mm-hmm. was crap. That sucked. And he's like, well, why not be positive about it? It's hard for me to talk to you when you're negative all the time. It's like, because it sucked. That's why I can't be positive. Yeah. And now it feels like I'm proud of what we're doing. I feel like we've hit a stride in the last 6 months that's like everything I could have hoped for in this project. And now it's like a springboard for what's going to happen next. But it has felt very gratifying, satisfying. So that yearning to even get to a place where I felt valid, where I could step off stage afterwards and accept compliments, took a while.
Do you need to practice? Do you need to rehearse at this point because you are playing so much and you're so locked into that mode?
We don't need to practice on how to be Iotto. Mm-hmm. That has now become a very rich place that he and I can just enter into, that all the tech has become subsided to where it's becoming a slave to our creativity. Mm-hmm. We've wrestled the tech into submission so the music can come forward. But there's still, like, you know, every time I pick up a guitar, like there's thousands of guitar players that are way better than me that I know immediately, you know? So there's always like
technical proficiency.
Well, practicing the instrument, yeah. Mm-hmm. Practicing the instruments that are involved. But as far as creating cohesive loops and song forms, the pressure is less on that and more on becoming a good musician on other realms.
Sure. So tell me about that couple of hours before the show. You've hauled in all the gear, so you've got it all in the building and you're running cables and all that. Do you and Jason communicate about that night's show, or at this point where you are now, is it just telepathy? You step on stage and you're in that Iotto mode.
It's just right in. We don't talk about, there's no discussion about music at all or anything that we might do. Or we generally, you know, get to the gig 3 hours before, do sound check, and then go to dinner and then just hang out sometimes together. Sometimes we just laugh a lot, basically. Mm-hmm. Our crew is awesome and funny, and there's no procedures that we engage in before we hit stage that are musically.
And it's never like, oh, you know, that thing we did in Nashville 3 nights ago, can we revisit that? It's you have to burn it once it's been done.
We try to burn and go, yeah. And not, I mean, my whole ethos, and I think his too, is to try not to consider what we've done before, because then that'll track us into things that sound more like we have previously and put a ceiling on our creative expression.
So then what is driving the Iotto sound? Is it what you're listening to on headphones in your downtime? Is it stuff that people show you, like, listen to this new sound, this is, you know, this is where electronic music is going next? Do you sit down and say, how can we capture this? And maybe what I'm thinking of is new trends in music, for instance, trap or new versions of electro?
That's times that we enter in, like when trap, 6, 8, 10 months ago, when trap started really hitting and we recognized it and enjoyed it, we tried to mull over how we could do that in our scenario and figured out a very appropriate solution and got a whole big trap thing and made a hand signal to designate going to trap. It was similar for us in 2008 when we first got dubstep, basically at Shambhala. We saw a scream set and we were in different places in the venue and mm-hmm. we're like, oh, I see. I get it. And so then I went to work trying to make sounds that sounded like that. Mm-hmm.
And then is it a process of easing it in over a number of shows? Like, okay, there's this new sound we've been tinkering with. I'm going to spring it on you. Or, I mean, I guess there is an element of surprise to it, since you're both improvising individually and coming together to do this, mm-hmm. that you're going to say, you know, I'm going for it. I'm launching this. We're gonna try this now.
Oh, well, I don't talk about new sounds that I've made with him at all. We just go for it like that.
Okay. Okay. But so it's a real dynamic interaction. When you're introducing something, he's got to react to it, and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And he gets all kinds of new effects and stuff, and we just show up and don't even talk about what we did new. We just let it ride out and see what that does to the music.
Is there an abort button? I mean, you're talking about hand signals, but is there some sort of signal that says, this is not working, We got to cut this loose and start fresh.
Yeah, basically this hand signal, mm-hmm. left to right, means same basic tempo concept but new idea.
Okay. Okay.
So if he's, and we usually, like, it's been a long time since I've come up with a totally shitty idea or something that was so poorly executed. It happens, you know, because mm-hmm. I'm self-arpeggiating all the parts, all the comping parts, you know, all the dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, and sometimes my hands will get messed up and I won't play it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And then I have to make an assessment. Is that bad enough that I should erase it and build a new one? Mm-hmm. Or just put a reverb on it and call it good?
Yeah.
But it's so, we're so in tune with each other musically now that there hasn't been the need for the abort symbol in a long time.
Okay. Do you ever get into, or I guess out of sync with the audience, in that you're playing something that you don't feel is quite cutting it, but the audience is very into it, and vice versa.
Yeah.
The audience is not, you know, not loving something you're doing, but you and Jason are locked in. Do you have to, as you said, assess the situation and say, is this worth, you know, scrapping, or do we go forth?
Well, generally, because we've played so many shows, like upwards of 900 plus shows now, mm-hmm. that we've come to trust ourselves more, as far as, like, if we look out at the audience and we're doing some slinky down-tempo thing and the audience is not dancing, it's like, well, they're in it. They're just not, they don't have the fist-pumping bro step moves that, you know, we know will come, and, mm-hmm. and just having the patience to. But yes, in essence, we can address anything that, I mean, you know. Like the other night, we played a show with Billy Nershey, the three of us, and there were moments where I was like, well, this crowd would rather we were playing something raunchier, I think. Mm-hmm. But then we're just like, okay. And we become more patient, not freaked out by the audience. We're like, we'll temper it and run our game and know that we'll swoop them in. But there is oftentimes, back when dubstep was just kind of coming to some sort of, if granted, we were also not very good at it, but say 2009 or so,
yeah,
we'd go into clubs, or 2008, early 2009, we'd go around the country and we'd start into, we'd be doing our, like, groovy, funky, housey, down-tempo time thing that we kind of came to be. I mean, we started as a down-tempo band, and mm-hmm. I love that. It's still my favorite stuff, the really gentle lounge down-tempo. Mm-hmm. And we'd get all revved up, and we'd drop the dubstep, and you could just see it, yeah. There'd be, most of the people would stop dancing and back up and be like, what the hell happened? And there'd be like three people that knew, they'd be like, this is my shit, and they'd come running to the front. They'd throw their fist, they'd do the chop thing, and then we'd stop the dubstep and go into something else, and those three people would go back, and everyone else would start dancing again. It was like this changing of the guard for a while with dubstep. But now it's, of course, like, mm-hmm. everyone.
Universally.
Except for String Cheese fans are into it.
Tell me about that, because, you know, you and Jason are locked in. You have this unspoken language. And then when you add somebody else into that mix, be mm-hmm. it Billy or Jamie and Steve Kimmock, when you do your other altered groups, the when you bring Kang in, is there a sort of shift in the temperature of the room? Do you have to allow for maybe slower transitions or give more space to let a new member in? I mean, how does that sort of adjustment work?
It's person to person, because each new personality we add in dictates a different pacing or a different languaging. It's really hard to tell until we start jamming.
Sure, sure. Do you find that the new member who's sort of stepping in, you let them sort of take it in the direction they want to? Or because you are such a locked-in unit with Jason, do you get to sort of lay the structure, and they can, if they're, for instance, a melodic instrument, guitar or dulcimer or in Billy's case, you know, was he adding lyrics in? Was he improvising?
No, not this time. He just played acoustic, electric, and lap steel.
Okay, okay. But when that member's added in, do you sort of lay the structure and let them decorate the tree, as it were?
Sometimes they're ornaments. Sometimes they're branches or trunks. It depends upon... It really is reading the scenario. Billy was very effortless to play with. Mm-hmm. The phrasing was just very apparent when it was supposed to go, and it was the same kind of phraseology that and modalities that Jason and I generally engage in, so mm-hmm. it was pretty effortless to switch the time. And I was kind of mandating the pacing and saying, here we go, new key, we're going to E, ready, go. And other times, like with Kimok, it's very amorphous journey, and you just have to kind of ride his solos and how long he wants to go, and mm-hmm. it seems to be a slower pacing. And he's also so not indoctrinated into electronic modalities that it's uh-huh. it's tough to drop something totally out of the blue on him. Although we do, you know, we do all the modes, but yeah, it's just player to player. It really is just kind of letting them. It's a mixture. Sometimes it'll be like, okay, it's time for me to take over.
Yeah.
It's time for me to drive the ship here because it's getting too meandery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And need some form. And Jason and I have, we have form and structure for days. We just right. engage it when it's time.
Exactly. I mean, because it's got to be intimidating to step into this two-headed monster that has such depth and, you know, you can read each other so well. So I imagine another member coming in, you have to do a lot to explain to them, you know, be comfortable, we're gonna follow you, we're gonna be able to dip and dunk where you want to, and you have a sort of safety net in us almost.
Yeah.
But I mean that's hard to explain before you go on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I guess, you know, you're not playing with amateurs here, these are professionals, you know what they're doing. So you don't need to handhold them in any way.
No, but they are. There is some, like with Steve, he's so in a different world that it kind of, he is the most extreme example of it just becoming a platform for him.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to like with Keith, I mean, we've played, you know, the Transcendent with Kyle and Kang, and that's obviously very easy. Mm-hmm. And Everslit tends to take on a more bluesy approach because of Kyle's way modality.
Mm-hmm.
And we played a show with Jamie Shields from The New Deal and Kang recently, the Net show, and that was great and easy for us to, you know, it's all just like, it's just feeling in the moment what each player is mandating or requesting of Jason and I.
Sure.
Kind of.
And Jamie has, you know, in his years with the New Deal, has a very deep knowledge of electronic modalities and also just the chops of a monster. So he's definitely able to step right into to what you and Jason are doing and really be able to follow that path with you, and doesn't require as much cushion, I guess.
Yeah. He helped structurally. But generally, overall, it's Jason and I calling the shots still, because everyone else is to some degree or another a fish out of water from what he and I are doing, because mm-hmm. you just have to be, because he and I have spent so much time together doing the thing. They're looking to us, generally, to say, all right, what's next? We'll be right back.
great many maps from the Zilla album Egg. Michael Travis on drums, Aaron Holstein, aka Vibe Squad, on guitar and bass, and dulcimer maestro Jamie Janiver make up the group, now in its 10th year.
You know, you just celebrated your 10th anniversary this year, and we got to see, as you said, Minneapolis is, you know, a great home for what you've been doing. So you got to see some of the first Zilla shows outside of Colorado in years in Minneapolis and a couple of other pockets. Mm-hmm. I guess probably fans want to know when or in what iteration they might see a new Zilla type thing.
Well, one thing that they could know about Zilla that was really exciting is that it was the most fun we've had playing in that band maybe ever. Mm-hmm. That, you know, all of our experiences out in the world, Janover doing Janover and Resonator and me doing Yodo and Jason and Aaron doing Vibe Squad is just cross-training for Zilla. And we've all modulated our behavior so much in our thoughts about it and about each other that we left stage on that mini tour. What did we do? Lincoln, Minneapolis, and Denver. Mm-hmm. Really enthused and thought that it was really impactful and has a whole new thing. It's less of a dance band and more of like a giant instrumental indie thing, but it was just really compelling. Really.
It's such a unique sound and format that you can't really capture it in any other form except for Zilla.
Yeah.
And Jamie doing his thing and Aaron doing something completely different, you know, DJing, producing. When you come back into this sort of format, is there a lot of rust to shake off, or is it? Is
there
it
was
really
zero rust
nature?
This time. It was incredible.
Yeah,
because I had been up on my chops because String Cheese had been playing, so I was a better drummer than I'd been in a minute. Mm-hmm. And just it was just everyone was just locked onto the big unified concept, which again, the all improv thing, it gets even hairier with Zilla. It's even more elusive because with Jason and I'm making all the tonal choices, and there's only two of us. And
right.
With Aaron and Jamie and I, all three of us are doing tonal stuff. And
Aaron can be percussive with his bass, or he can be melodic with it, and has to interact with Jamie on a certain level.
Yeah, I thought Aaron played just like jaw-droppingly, like, I can't believe I'm in a band with this guy.
He's a technical wizard on the guitar. Like, he is an incredible genius.
He has learned to take his bass playing, his guitar playing, and his keyboard playing and enter some new meta zone of just giving it all up to the whole. Mm-hmm. He's just, it's right in the, it's just in the biggest, most beautiful giving pocket right now. It's so fun.
That's exciting. So, I mean, there's nothing on the calendar.
Nothing on
as
the
of
books
yet.
Right now. Mm-hmm. We should do another little run. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Oh, the audience is certainly there. And you know, the more time you take away, the more that desire is there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Especially after this last one where I think we left a mark again.
So. Absolutely. Sure. So let's talk about that. I guess Zilla was sort of running its course in the mid 2000s, 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And that's when you and Jason just start tinkering with the newest in technology and just essentially jamming together, getting together on percussive instruments and feeling each other out.
Yeah. It was 2005 when Jason joined String Cheese, and he would fly out to practices and he would stay at my house. And after practice, we'd go home and be like, let's jam. Yeah. And he'd set up my kit. And I was very, very into tapping. Double hand tapping, which I thought would be my main expression tonally. Mm-hmm. And I had a 7-string bass, and we'd just rage jam style. And I had a cheap loop pedal because I'd been working on looping a lot. Mm-hmm. Really dug into it for a while. And then that had come to a place where he's like, well, you know, we could really, there's this program, Ableton Live, that would really modify our way of looking at everything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm down. And he basically built the whole thing. It was his knowledge of Ableton that allowed for this project to come about in its current incarnation. It was kind of, you know, my idea to do a duo or a looping duo, and he had all the skills to make it actually happen.
At this point, are the high technology folks in music looking to you and saying, we're going to build you a custom rig, or we're going to, you know, come to you with this new app or this new program that's going to, you know...
Occasionally, but strangely, we haven't been foisted onto the creators of Ableton and people like that enough, in my opinion, about what we're doing. The resonance hasn't filtered through that. What we both feel is exceedingly unique and noteworthy technically has not come to be recognized, potentially.
Do you think it's because people just aren't at the level that you are? Because not only is there a lot of technical proficiency happening with the technology, but you're so good at the instruments and the interplay between the two of you is so dynamic that the Ableton crowd just hasn't caught on to it because they're not sure that anybody else could do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of people saying that we improvise and so on in Ableton. I'm not sure why it's definitely farther ahead of what most people can conceptualize we're doing. Even musicians don't really understand how staunchly adherent we are to the modality of improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everyone thinks like, so, you know, oftentimes I get really talented, skilled musicians come up to me and say, so you've got like, what do you got? You got chunks of bass parts that you just trigger samples? I'm like, nope, none of that. So you got some arpeggiations going? Nope, just play it.
And at this point, I'm sure you've seen copycats out there, or at least people trying to engage in this sort of symbiosis of the technical organic instruments and the programming.
There's plenty of examples of people doing things that are similar, but there's always
programmed
some
chunks.
Pre-recorded element.
Sure.
And to a greater or lesser degree, you know, like Big Gigantic has got live elements,
mm-hmm.
and I love those guys, and I love their music. But the biggest chunk of the music part is pre-recorded.
Sure, sure, yeah. And then you know when you come up against a new piece of technology, do you feel like because nothing's really written or structured for the sort of whatever it is you call it that you're doing, the Eodo sound and the Eodo structure, do you feel like there is the need for custom technology for what you're doing? Or have you just jerry-rigged the system together with all these bits and pieces of programs that you're going to try and
make work? I could certainly use a piece of custom machinery. It would be nice to have a really top-notch MIDI control maker make me this dream knob rig up top for volumes, mutes, and effects, which I now use old Behringer BCR 2000s, which are, call them old, they're like 6-7 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, that's a ton of money, and I get everything I need out of it because Jason tends to be the one that does super intricate internal MIDI messaging, really incredibly in-depth automated effects and stuff. And I just want to, all my needs are for my MIDI to turn on and off tracks that I've built, you know, clips, and to affect them in some very rudimentary ways,
mm-hmm.
and volumes.
Sure.
And I'm trying to delve, right now at least, my instinct is to delve more into mastering pacing, which doesn't have anything to do with the tech, just up to me doing it.
Mm-hmm.
pacing and musical validity, so it's just like more studying the instrument, making tones that are super compelling.
Sure.
And just rocking the pacing. And if I get new gear, I find that the more new tech I get, the less good I am at achieving my goal of immaculate pacing, because the more all the tech stuff can just become something my hands do. That's why I love having had these MIDI controllers and everything for so many years, and the same synths, the same everything, is that I can, my hands and my body, like, I'll be doing incredibly intricate maneuvers that a few years ago I would have thought impossible, but like finishing a part, and then before I even finish recording and press the end record button, I'm muting another part, putting a delay on another part, then I end record, then I bring that part up, and like, because the tech has been the same for so long, my body's artistry with it has allowed to percolate to the surface.
And I imagine if your stand is half an inch shorter than it's supposed to be, the muscle memory and the musculature is off.
It's everything, off. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder with that high tech aspect of what Eodo is doing, was it a conscious decision on your part to really stick with keeping organic instruments in there? Obviously, when Eodo's doing the down-tempo stuff and going tribal and psychedelic in 2005, 2006, you've got a lot of hand percussion, you've got a lot of stringed instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And as the sound that you've developed sort of changes with the times, you're invoking dubstep and electro, mm-hmm. and trap. Do you consciously say at some point during the show tonight, I'm going to pick up a mandolin, or I'm going to,
yeah, you know, I'm going to bring the mando out. Yes, it has always been a part of my goal, is to always infuse that. And the To be truthful about it all, the guitar, I've been working on being a guitar player for as long as I've been working on being a drummer. Since mm-hmm. I was 20, I almost picked up the instruments, congas and acoustic guitar at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I've always wanted to be able to play guitar on stage.
Sure.
And bass, you know, and it's the thing I notice with a crowd is it's when Iotto crowd or just crowds in general get what's going on more. If they see me just hunched over a keyboard, their mind, due to the kind of electronic psychological bludgeoning that's gone on, they just see knobs. They're like, oh, he's pushing knobs up there.
And see in their heads the DJs
they see. They've seen in they the see past. Big gigantic and you know pretty lights in their or previous incarnation, a DJ and a drummer, which is a very popular modality. Mm-hmm. And they just translate it as opposed to there's a dude with a bunch of keyboards playing keyboard lines. But when I pick up a bass or a guitar, it's a very big visual cue that's sure. being played live.
And suddenly you can hear what you're doing and really
yeah.
Connect
I mean, you
with
can
it.
Hear the keyboard lines, sure. but you just don't. Your brain doesn't connect them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just think, oh, it's music.
Yeah, it's happening somehow.
Yeah. But so when I pick up a bass and do like some intricate tapping line and then record it and then the tapping line's going and I stop, that's when people get the aha moment. So it's mm-hmm. a really big connection for them to see that. And I just love fucking playing.
Sure.
Bass now is my favorite. I love bass. And I got my bass sounding so badass. It's as big as all the synthesizers now, which is super exciting. So
okay.
Every time I pick it up, no matter what other raunchy-ass bass line is, I pick up the bass and it's just as profound sounding. So that's exciting.
Bit of a journey there. First, Stutterbury from 2009's K Turns and U Turns, Iotto's annual Best Of compilation. Then Vacuum Step from Miami in April 2010. Finally, we jumped ahead to Hygna from this past May. You can access full set recordings and archives from each Iotto show at iottomusic.com.
You and Jason are dicking around in the basement and playing with all these toys. At what point do you say we're ready? We're ready to go get ourselves a show. We're ready to go get on stage with it.
That's a funny story. Well, we got a gig. In 2005 when we started it, it came about like Christmas, and Jamie said, well, are you ready? You got this new project, right, that you're working on? Do you guys want to have Sonic Bloom be your first show? Because Sonic Bloom had been going for a few years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, yeah, so then we had a deadline. But the other thing was, like, about December 2005, we had gotten to the point where before the first dual-core Intel MacBook Pro had come out, we were working on a G4 laptop, the ones with the little round power plugs, like the old school.
Yeah.
That was the top of our latency, and we could not, we had implemented so much stuff. Basically, we'd be like jamming on the rig as we had it up to that moment. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, wait. And I taxed Jason so hard back in those early days, because I was just such a stoner, flaky dude. I was like, I want to do this. Make it so I can do this, you know? And he'd add something, and then he'd say to himself, I need to do this, and he'd work on the template, and we just keep working, till it was like, wow, this is fun. We're doing something, but you know what's happening? We are outplaying the computer
because we have to have
the latency so high for the computer to actually run its paces on it that the delays are extremely out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like a triplet delay that should go, dunt, gunt, 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 would go. God, you know, it would be off, sagging and pulling on everything.
Sure.
And it was like, this is unacceptable. We can't play
mm-hmm.
a show. What are we going to do? And then something like, we could look up when the first MacBook Pro came out, but in like, it must have been like January 2006.
Sure, yeah.
Or February.
And I might still have that one.
The minute it came out and we plugged our template into it, all the problems were solved, and then we were ready to play a show.
So, and you're portable now.
Well, yeah. No, the other one was just a G4 laptop, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's still a laptop.
It was a laptop, but it wasn't the dual-core Intel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really, we beat Apple. We were ahead of the curve on Apple to be able to make it a live scenario. It was part of the reason probably the live thing hadn't started. So we were very, very much on the cutting edge of when a project like this could have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple predecessors that we're really impressed with. One guy in particular, Kid Beyond. Kid Beyond is a big looping man, did a lot of great stuff. So is Imogene Heap.
Sure.
They're very big looping inspirations.
Okay, yeah.
And Kid Beyond, you know, we'd watch him. He did the same thing, except he knew what he was going to do on every part.
Yeah.
Separating. But he would just sit with a looping MIDI controller and a microphone, build all his own drums, build all his own bass lines, but it was all beatbox. So he was a big inspiration for sure.
And it's working in a box, in a looping console.
He was the first guy that we were looking at his template. I remember in like 2000... We were already doing it. Oh, no, it was Zilla, I think he played. I was like, let me see what you're doing here. And we looked at his Ableton template, and he showed us how it works and all that. But he was triggering loops, building loops in Ableton.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, obviously you had caught up with the technology, but were there early believers that really helped lay the foundation for what Iotto would become? People who, you know, knew what you guys were working on and said, hey, come out and play this in XYZ place or city or venue, and said, this is something, this is going to be the next thing.
You mean like who really saw the power at first?
Sure.
Yeah, that certainly started to happen. When we first started touring, we thought, as I know String Cheese members have all reflected upon this, like Billy's like, I thought I was going to be famous when I went, you know. I thought everyone would show up that showed up at String Cheese shows, and that's just not the case, mm-hmm. you know.
Especially with a project so vastly different from what you were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we first show we played six people and something like that, and it was tough at first. But the first town that really grabbed us and said, you're ours, and we fucking love it, and we won't stand for anything else, was Minneapolis. It was great. We mm-hmm. had some very, very profound shows. We had a whole run of every 6 months we'd come back to the Caboose up there, which is a great little kind of divey venue.
Yeah.
And and people would just eat us alive. It gave us the power to keep going, because they got us on such a profound level, really deeply emotional or spiritual about it.
Minneapolis is a great town for electronic music. It's a great town,
yeah.
And there's so many connections between it and the Boulder, Denver area.
In the
acts that they really care about and the sounds that they're willing to embrace. It's a very forward-thinking town, and not just for electronic music, but also indie music. And
it's a great town.
It's really fascinating because, as part of your loose master plan, if there was one, it was, we're going to go to these towns. We're going to play the diviest dive there until we are big enough to graduate to the bigger, better venues.
Yeah.
Was that, I mean, playing for six people off the bat, because you had been through this before and had the experience and wisdom, as it were, that when you make good music, people are going to come. Did that make it a little easier? Or when you're playing seven nights a week in these little dives, how do you sort of retain that musical integrity and say, you know, we believe in this project, we're doing this, this is a good sound that people will get on board with?
Well, we both envisioned, I think we both, you know, he's much more musical experienced than I am over the years, but I think we both just trusted our vision of what it would become, and knowing that every show we played was just basically, I was always like, I'm getting paid to play guitar for people, which has been a dream of mine for so many friggin' years. And that dream was not mitigated by being a drummer in front of thousands of people in string cheese at all.
Sure, sure.
It was like a parallel pursuit. And so I was just so happy. I felt like I'm getting to play tonal instruments for people. I'm getting to make up melodies and play them for people. And that's super awesome. So that rode me through a lot of it. And both of us just kept, it was such a constant evolution that... once we got rolling, we didn't really care about how many people were there or not, because we always knew that it wasn't exactly where we wanted it to be. So once it was, then we'd be bummed if people weren't showing up. And we've gone through many spasms of, it hasn't, obviously we haven't been on the growth curve of like the greatest exponential curve available, being, you know, Skrillex and then Bass Nectar and Big Gigantic and all these guys that just go whing and Pretty Lights.
But at the same time, your sound has definitely reached a greater audience because of the growth of electronic music, or do you feel like you're sort of riding alongside of it and not really a part of it? Do you feel like you're
independent? We feel like we're kind of the black sheep. There's different parts of it that I think that the fact that there's no hit songs, like every time people go to a Skrillex show, they know at some point they're going to get to yell, "Oh my God!"
Sure.
And that brings them in. Or the songs that are repeated, the familiarity. Is stark for people, and we sucked for a lot of years, so that's tough for people. I mean, like, I felt like one of the main appealing things about electronic music for people, I think, is that it is dependable. People go, electronic music fans don't have, I would think, tended to not be rockin' or like jam band fans, because jam band fans embrace the mistakes. They like the precipice of the unknown. They like to see the ship almost tip over and then right itself.
Sure.
Whereas electronic music fans are like, I want my shit perfect, and I want it perfect every fucking time.
They're slaves to the beat, and they expect that beat to be on the floor.
And that's great, and it is perfect.
Yeah.
And since we're kind of merging those worlds of jam band, I think we lost some of the electronic heads. I think another subtler factor is that we're older gentlemen. And the young 18-year-olds can't look up and see heroes exactly. They see their dads. It's a different, or their granddads even in my case. So it doesn't translate for hero worship. So it's a very raw, real thing. It's like, you're going to like Yoda because you like being in the unknown. You like this incredible adventure, which is a very powerful team. I love our team, but it's not as readily available to launch into exponential growth curve.
No, it's not easily digestible or yeah.
And we also went the route of, in our constant exploration, we would constantly change. And at first, string cheese fans all showed up the first round, and they're like, ew, electronic music, I'm not going again. So then we our first wave went and fell away. And then we started to get ahead of steam with all the weirdos, and we had some great stuff going on. In fact, 2008, 2009... And then we got obsessed with dubstep because we thought it was the edgy. And it was, for a minute there, I thought it was the most profound expression ever. And it's still, it hits.
It's primal.
What happened? Yeah, it created a pocket. It punched out a wall in music and created a new room that was not there before. I'm absolutely convinced. Trap, I don't feel that way about. But dubstep took the wall and just said, this is the new edge of what it is to be alive in a modern, terrifying technological society. And this is the expression of perfect grace and perfect terror at the same time.
Absolutely. My girlfriend at the time, wife now, saw her first Yodo show, I think it was in the barn at summer camp, and said, this is the most terrifying and exhilarating thing at the same time. Yeah. We've got, you know, we're the people that sought it out, and, you know, we're punching the air at 2 a.m. on a Sunday, and this is, it's dirty and clean at the same time, and, you know, it was really freeing.
It's very, very profound, because I have this sense, like, when we were in the middle of the darkest dubstep wave, and when I really was getting it, it contained more than any other music. Like, happy music can't contain darkness, but dark actually intrinsically includes light above it. It's just a deeper well that you're going behind. And I remember Clay Parnell, the bass player for Brothers Past and Biodiesel.
He's in Biodiesel.
He stated it to me once. He's like, yeah, it's not angry. Dubstep isn't angry dark. It's majestic dark. And I was like, that's it.
Yeah.
It is beautiful. It's regal. It's like auditory crop circles too. I found myself like remembering when I was an alien and remembering past lives and stuff. I remember one time in an Excision show, I was just standing there being like, all right, you know, Excision, I love this guy. He was a huge initial inspiration. We listened to a set of SPLs that had an Excision song. SPL was our original hero of dubstep. And like we left Shambhala and we were driving through Washington just like, oh my God, what happened? And we just listened to the SPL set on repeat for days. And yeah, I remember being at a Excision show and he dropped this sound. It was just a one sound where I was like, huh. And I just felt like it dissolved my identity and made me a much broader entity, or made me remember big, broader versions of myself.
Sure.
So it's very, very profound. It's obviously, and it's also, I also have, and it's also very angst-ridden for the 18-year-olds. They can get their angst out. It's like punk.
Yeah.
But it's the first time that I think spiritual expansion music, sex music, and angst dissident music have all occurred at the same head of a pin.
Yeah.
Like, you look at punk, that was just the angsty boys.
Sure.
Chicks couldn't give a shit.
Right.
And then you look at neo-soul, where all the sexy people go to get sexy, and it wasn't being protesty at all, and it wasn't rising you spiritually, it was just giving you a hard-on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new age stuff was kind of in charge of all the spiritual enlightenment stuff, or in my lexicon, at least in this. Now it's all right on one spot.
Sure.
So people are hating their parents, grinding on some chick and remembering their past lives all at the same time.
I think you just made a case for it being the perfect expression of sonic architecture. I think it's all in there and everything it needs to be, spiritual, sexual, and bang your head on the wall.
Yeah,
express.
Yeah, release.
Certainly.
But Jason and I have now realized that we can't keep up with the great greats of dubstep or any genre. We're just ourselves, and that. When we got obsessed with dubstep, we sloughed a whole nother bunch of people that loved us for being our little quirky selves.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want us to be a giant ugly dubstep machine.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that's where we wanted to be for a second. And then we realized that it's in our best interest and in our roots, and we were belying our own instincts by doing that, so that we were just going to settle back into as organic and far-reaching a curve of stylistic variance that we could possibly muster.
Sure.
And like the string cheese of electronic music. And that's kind of where we're at now. Just feeling really happy with so many times in the last couple months of shows, like almost every show, Jason and I walk off and go, that's right.
you're in that groove.
Yeah.
And part of that, part of matching the sonic exploration that you're doing is finding the perfect visual pair for that. And I think that you've achieved that with the Lotus stage setup, and it's been a year now since you've introduced that, and it's become such an integral part of what Yodo is. Do you feel like you found your visual companion for what it is that you're doing, because there are so many angles and so many takes and so many different things you can do with it.
I think
it.
We're going to give it a rest. This is going to be the last tour coming up in November. Okay. We're going to do a tour almost of all of November, a number of shows. And I think we're going to try to move on after that. We're working on new concepts.
Okay, okay.
It just feels like you could go with the visual companion take, which is a nice take on it. But yeah, like there's two ways to look at it. This is our visual companion and this is our mark, or time to bring out a new mark. And I think we're going to work on that.
Okay. And in deciding what it is that is the best visual representation of what Eodo is, I don't know if you're artists at heart or have some sort of design. Do you leave that up to a team of people who do this? Or do you really come to them and say, you know, we've got this idea and our sound is pointy and it's, you know, it flashes in this direction and it rotates counterclockwise?
We have a guy, Zebler, that, you know, our visual guy, that is the VJ for the content that has been instrumental in a lot of our visual pursuits. Like when we first got on board with Ron Rivlin and Coast to Coast Management, he's like, well, we need a visual something, so we're going to hang a big curtain behind you and beam on it. And then Zebler joined us. And then me and Jason like co-designed the, everyone kind of co-designed the Lotus. We'd feed back and forth ideas. But he's the one that came up with this is what it can look like, and this is my guy that'll build it for this much money. And he is now doing that with the next thing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Any hints?
Lots of video feedback of us being involved in big structures behind us and stuff. So it's like content with us. Because we've often felt with the Lotus, one of the complaints is that everyone's looking at this Lotus and they're hearing our music and they love the whole picture. But I think the fact that we are being musicians, actual improvised, because I think a lot of DJs are trying to distract from the fact that they're just standing up there waving their hand around.
Sure, there's a disconnect that they are relying on versus you guys actually need that connection. You need
we need that connection, and we need people to notice that this shit is going down right now, and it's never going to go down again like this. And so instead of being at the Lotus with us in it, it's going to be us everywhere.
Okay.
And I've got a scheme for the next year after that, too, that was too expensive right now, but we're already mulling over the thing after the thing. So
Okay. The technology's got to catch up with you guys once again.
It does, yeah, yeah.
That's life on the brink, I suppose.
That's good, yeah. It's exciting.
Well, Michael Travis, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about Eodo and where you've been and where you're going.
All right. Cool.
Summum, recorded back in August by Eodo. We're giving that one away as a free download. Special thanks go to Amy Heinrich of Tsunami Publicity, Corbin Koski with Coast to Coast Entertainment, and of course, my guest, Michael Travis. Beginning November 6th, Eodo will be hitting the Southeast, Midwest, and the great state of California before cruising through Colorado in December for six dates, culminating in a giant tour closing throwdown at the Fillmore in Denver on December the 7th. As always, ticket information and dates are at theunts.com. Tickets at theunts.com has all the tickets to all the club dates on Michael Mennert's Fall 2013 Space Jazz Tour. Join the Michael Mennert Mafia and get limited edition posters, stickers, and $5 off purchases of $15 or over at the Michael Mennert online store. Checking in on our contest page, we're giving away a ton of tickets in Columbus. Fans have a chance to see Beats Antique, Steve Aoki, Pretty Lights, or Time Flies for free. We've got festival passes to Freak Night in Seattle, a huge EDM ticket pack to the Pageant in St. Louis, featuring free pairs of tickets to see Flux Pavilion with Schism, Lotus with the Floozies and Cosby Sweater, and Datsik with Funtcase and Protohype. And of course, huge Halloween prizes with free tickets and a gift certificate for STS9 at the Austin Music Hall, or Suwanee's Halloween with String Cheese Incident, STS9, Big Gigantic, Emancipator, and Too Many to Mention down in Live Oak, Florida at the end of October. It takes under a minute to sign up for free, and then you can enter all of our contests with the click of a button. Please visit theunts.com for news, artist profiles, tour dates, and tickets to some of the biggest shows across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunz.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theunz.com. Join the conversation at the UNS podcast on Twitter.